Think of all the books that have influenced who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Abedone. Today, you'll hear my conversation with author Julia Flynn Seiler in a live virtual event with an audience of book lovers. Starting in the Gold Rush era, a handful of San Francisco missionaries gave sanctuary to Chinatown's prostitutes and their children. We follow the managers and residents of Mission Home from 1848 through the 1960s in Julia Flynn Seiler's The White Devil's Daughters. They survived earthquake and fire, plague and pandemic, political and gang corruption and racism. The White Devil's Daughters combines history and biography with photos and descriptions culled from diaries, newspaper articles, and state archives. The stories of resiliency center around two addresses on the edge of one of San Francisco's most prestigious neighborhoods. Spending the time that I have spent in Chinatown, I never really thought to look for these two places. They're both on Sacramento Street, and they were both home to Mission Home. One is 933, and the other one is 920. Sacramento Street, where Mission Home has always been located, runs perpendicular to Grant and Stockton, right?
Probably the easiest way to locate it is the iconic Fairmont Hotel, and it is literally a stone throws away, like a block and a half away from the Fairmont, which is on the tippy top of Knob Hill. So if you go down the hill, that's where 920 is, and 933 Sacramento Street, the original Mission Home or Safe House, was across the street from that. So it's on the edge of Chinatown, Donna.
It's on the edge of Chinatown and also on the edge of Knob Hill, which is an interesting sort of a location for all of this history to have happened. Now, even before the gold rush, there was immigration from China, right? Why were people coming from China before the gold rush? What was going on in San Francisco?
Before the gold rush? The very first woman believed, Chinese woman believed to have come to San Francisco was a servant, an indentured servant to a white family, a trader. And that's how she arrived there. And then soon after, there was the gold rush. And the original Chinatown was built around Portsmouth Square, which is the first place that the American flag was raised in San Francisco. And then, of course, the railroad project began, and that drew even more Chinese men to the state.
Chinese men. See, that's an interesting point. Even though that one woman came very early on, who you mentioned, most of the immigrants from China to San Francisco were men. And at one point around the gold rush, the ratio was 10 to 1, I think. Yes. And then it got even crazier by 1890, 22 to 1. Really a bachelor society.
Yes, yes. And although that's a kind of a funny term, because a number of the men who came to the United States to work left families behind and wives behind. They fully intended to go back to China. And that's why through much of the 19th century, the men kept the long braids in the back of their they would wear their hair in the queues. So while it was known as a bachelor society, in fact, some of those men were married men.
So bachelor society more in terms of being alone in the community rather than unmarried in the community.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, that set up a situation for a huge demand for sex.
Yeah. So that's where prostitution came in. These were not men looking for spouses. They weren't looking for wives. So prostitution was what was going on instead. And interracial marriage was still illegal for many years after the gold rush. So even those men who may have been looking for a wife, if there were very few women in San Francisco, wouldn't have had that much luck.
That's absolutely right. Yes. So there was quite a lucrative business opportunity for traffickers who could get women to Chinatown and to San Francisco for that matter. And those traffickers were, in some cases, the Chinese criminal Tongs, who were very organized in terms of trafficking young girls and women to the city. But they were helped along the way by white officials, white city officials. And there were a lot of different layers of people who were profiting from this sex trade.
So a Tong is the equivalent of a gang. Is that correct, that it's an equivalent or not quite?
Well, a Tong is an organization. And let me be very clear, not all Tongs are criminal Tongs. So I'm talking specifically about criminal Tong organizations.
Okay.
Which are like gangs, exactly, criminal
gangs. Yeah, okay. So slavery was already illegal in the U.S. by the time of the Gold Rush. But the trafficking of women from China for purposes of prostitution, maybe other places in the country, but we're talking about San Francisco, that resembled slavery. How was that possible?
Absolutely. Of course, the United States outlawed slavery at the very end of the Civil War, which is in 1865. Yet the trafficking of women, as you point out, Donna, was very much like slavery because women were not, girls were not permitted to come and go as they pleased. They had no rights. And many times they were very badly abused by their owners. The typical amount of time that a young girl who was forced into slavery in the 19th century might live was about 4 or 5 years, if she was lucky.
Mm. These were young women. They were girls, in a lot of cases, who were taken out of China, maybe sometimes willingly, but it sounds like there was a lot of kidnapping going on as well, and some debt paying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And sometimes families in desperate financial situations would sell daughters. So there were a variety of different ways in which young girls and women would end up in a trafficked situation. I think it's safe to say none of them chose to be in that situation.
Yeah. The women who came to San Francisco, who were trafficked to the area, did not live well, as you mentioned. It was against their will, but it was also a very unfortunate life.
Absolutely.
What did it look like?
Well, sometimes very large groups of young women and girls would disembark onto the wharves. And in the early days, those groups of women might be auctioned off straight away. In other cases, there were newspaper reports in the 19th century of wagon loads of these young girls and women being brought up to Chinatown. And then they would go to an area that might be known as the Queen's Room, which was in a sense, essentially a corral for the young women, in which they potential buyers could inspect them and they'd be sold off as well. And the girls and young women might end up in nice parlor kind of situations, or they might end up in a far worse situation known as a crib. And these were very small, often divided by a sheet, little areas where they might service 12, 14, 16 men a night.
Mm. And how many women might be in that situation together?
Ooh. Well, there was a very famous one of these brothels. It was called the Municipal Crib, given that name around the turn of the century because it was owned and operated by white people who were very close to the city administration. There were 100 young women living in that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they were very large enterprises.
There were also young women who were, as you said, in somewhat better situations. Not everyone was brought forward as a prostitute. Not everyone lived in squalor. Some were unpaid, maybe not always treated very well, but living within family homes.
Yes, absolutely. So there is a cultural tradition in the 19th century of child servants, essentially indentured child servants. So a family might reach out to a wealthier family and say, please take my daughter as little sister, Mutsai. Mm. And this little sister would perform tasks around the house. And sometimes they were treated very well as part of the family. Other times they would work as servants until they came of age, and then they'd be sold essentially as prostitutes. So a number of girls and women came over that way too.
So into this situation come a number of people, including a gentleman named Reverend Otis Gibson, who started Mission Home. What was the purpose at the beginning of Mission Home?
The people who really understood the conditions of Chinese girls and women in Chinatown at the time were Christian missionaries for the most part. They were living in Chinatown and they could see firsthand what was going on, including once girls became ill or abused, sometimes they'd be left on the streets to die. Mm-hmm. And the Otis Gibson, the Reverend Otis Gibson, became a great champion for Chinese American rights during that period of time. He would speak out on their behalf, and he was the first person to set up essentially a little rescue home, a little apartment where girls and women who wanted to escape their situation could go to. And he was known as the Jesus Man.
The Jesus Man, because he was a minister. That's very that's very interesting. And I want to go over a couple of the other names of some of the more notable people who were involved in Mission Home. Margaret Culbertson, tell us about her.
Yes. So as I mentioned, it was the missionaries and the wives of the missionaries who were really very aware of what was going on in Chinatown, and particularly amongst the girls and women. And it was a very small group of missionaries' wives and mostly middle-class church women who came together in 1873 and decided that they wanted to try to do something, try to help this group of people. And the backdrop to this is incredible violence against the Chinese during that period of time. Shortly before that, in Los Angeles, there had been a lynching of 18 Chinese men. There was widespread violence across the West and also in San Francisco. So this small group of women decided, let's do something. So they essentially rented a little apartment, and they let it be known that if a girl or woman needed to take refuge, they could come to this place. It was chaotic. It didn't work very well at the beginning. The women were spat at. They were really taking action that was against kind of the cultural moor of racist sentiment at the time by reaching out to the Chinese. Finally, they found a woman named Margaret Culbertson to come run this organization. And she was a very warm woman, very organized, very compassionate. She'd been born in China. She had a greater cultural sensitivity. And under her leadership, the home really started to operate in the way that its supporters had hoped it would.
How had they hoped it would run?
Well, they hoped it would be an orderly home in which women could take refuge and ultimately become Christians and find husbands. Now, remember, we're in the Victorian era, and that was the ultimate aspiration of a woman, was to become and to run a Christian household. And so that was the goal of this safe house.
The sanctuary, Christianity, and marriage.
Yes.
Pretty much.
Yes.
Okay.
Was
the direction they had planned.
Yeah. And essentially the home, by this time under Margaret Culbertson, had moved across the street to 920 Sacramento Street, which is a great big, very large home that could house up to 50, 60 women at one time. It became kind of a marriage bureau under her. And, you know, men, we talked earlier, Donna, about the incredible gender discrepancy, 20 to 1, mm-hmm. men to women. And it became known that there were women available, single women available at this home. And men would come from around the country to find the women there.
933 the original home of Mission Home. And the addresses might not seem all that important to any other book. We might not spend so much time on the actual addresses, but people are going to go to San Francisco and look for these locations. And 920 is still very visible and very active and very identifiable. And as you said, that large area in 920 turned out to be important, not just for the family atmosphere that was put together at Mission Home, but for all those weddings. They took place right there in the parlor.
Yes, they did. And one of the young women who was mentored by Barbara Culbertson became friends with the head of Golden Gate Park, and he would provide cuttings and greenery for those weddings, which would be, you know, made a little bit nicer with the flowers and the greens. Yes.
How lovely. Now, Margaret Culbertson had a niece who also took part in, was Belle running Mission Home or working there? What was her position?
This was a niece from upstate New York, and she spent a little bit of time there. So she would help prepare for weddings. She would run errands. She would do baking. She got to know the residents of the home and to care and enjoy them. And she wasn't there very long. She never ran the home. It was always Margaret who did that.
After Culbertson died, this tall, striking woman from Scotland via New Zealand named Dolly Cameron. And Dolly Cameron had a lot to do with Mission Home and really grew it and really did a lot for the women in that region. Talk a little bit about Dolly Cameron.
Sure, I'd love to. She's such a wonderful California woman that I hope people will come to understand and know more about. So she was born in New Zealand to a Scottish family. Her father was a sheep farmer, and he thought that he could come to California and raise a different type of sheep here and be successful. So she arrived in San Francisco as a very young girl, a toddler, with her mother and her five siblings. And she was growing up on a ranch in Southern California. Her father became the ranch manager for Lucky Baldwin, another larger-than-life California character. And Dolly was engaged. And somehow that engagement ended. And she heard through a family friend that there was a job opening for a sewing teacher in San Francisco. And so she took the train up to San Francisco in 1895, climbed the steps at 920 Sacramento Street, fully intending to be a sewing teacher at a home for Chinese girls. And there was a photograph taken shortly around that time, perhaps right before then, which she's wearing white gloves and beautiful, delicate veil over her face. Well, as soon as she arrived in the home, she pretty much realized it was totally different than what she'd expected.
The term, the white devil, because these women who were taking in the prostitutes and other women around Chinatown who were in trouble, these Christian ladies were part of the white devil as seen by some of the people in Chinatown. Talk a little bit about how that term came to be and how the other term, the white devil's daughters, came to be and how that plays in.
Happy to. So Dolly Cameron arrived in 1895, as I mentioned. She quickly rolled up her sleeves, got to work, and she became such a threat to the traffickers at the time that they gave her the name the White Devil. And of course, that is a racist sobriquet, but it was widely used at the time. And in turn, Dolly Cameron was deeply loved and respected by many of the young women who took refuge at the home. They came to refer to her as the mother or Lomo, and she referred to them as daughters. And so that's where the title of the book comes from, The White Devil's Daughters. So the white devil referring to Dolly Cameron, the daughters referring to the young women who took refuge at the home. One of the most touching parts of my research was to go to the archives at Stanford University and to come across files containing Mother's Day cards to Dolly Cameron from young women from around the world, thanking her and expressing their affection for her on Mother's Day. Now, another enormous challenge, of course, that Dolly and the women who were at the home faced was the 1906 earthquake. I wish I had some photographs to share with you about that, but you can look at those on the CAP Radio Reads site. There's one iconic photograph in particular that was taken the morning of the earthquake, about 100 yards up from the Mission House. So it was in fact Dolly Cameron's incredible first-person account of leading the residents of the home, about 60 young girls, women, even babies, through the burning streets, through the dark smoke that was rising up, through the chaos of that morning of April 18th, 1906, that made me want to write this book. I just thought that was really fascinating. And I'm a native Californian. I grew up in the Bay Area, and I never knew about this home or about Dolly Cameron. So we're in 1906. So Dolly was leading this very large group of people, Chinese people, across the burning city. They ended up taking refuge in a church on Van Ness Avenue the night of the earthquake, April 18th. The next morning, they made their way about a mile to the Embarcadero. Somehow, this large group managed to get on a boat and get across the bay. And they became earthquake refugees in Marin County. And in fact, they took refuge in a barn that is, where it was, I should say, about a mile from our house now. And they lived in Marin, which is where I live, for about 3 to 4 months. Then they moved to Oakland, like so many members of the Chinatown community did. Eventually, they were able to raise enough money to rebuild the Mission Home, and it reopened about a year and a half after the earthquake, and they all moved back in. And when you go visit 920 Sacramento Street, you can see the house that has almost not changed at all since the earthquake, because it was rebuilt with clinker bricks, which were those wonderful molten bricks that were often salvaged to reconstruct the city after the earthquake.
Tell us a little bit about what Victorian compromise was and how that concept had a role in Mission Home.
One of the things this book explored was the very complex way in which the white community and the Chinese community interacted with each other during those years. And as I've said before, there was tremendous racism against the Chinese during that time. There was there were a series of laws against the Chinese owning property, against Chinese children going to public schools, et cetera, et cetera. The Victorian Compromise is a very, very interesting concept. And the idea was that as long, it has to do with sexual mores during that period of time. And as long as the sanctity of the home was not broached in any way, that men, Victorian era men, could really express whatever they'd like with their sexuality. And in this case, it was a reflection of the fact that white men became customers for the Chinese brothels and Chinese sex a great deal of the time in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so while there were people who were thundering against the supposed immorality and the supposed uncleanliness of Chinatown, in fact, it was often white men and boys who were in those Chinatown brothels. So that's where the term Victorian Compromise comes from. And to return to the municipal crib, which was one of my favorite kind of little stories to tell. This was a very large brothel on Jackson Street that was financed by the family of the mayor at the time. And it was so well known and so popular that there was a trolley that went past it. And when there were no ladies on the trolley or women on the trolley operator might say something like, "All out for the whorehouse." In other words, everybody knew it was a brothel. And there were women of all kinds of backgrounds and nationalities who were working there. And it was often the white officials who were profiting from this. So those days in Barbary Coast / wild San Francisco are very, very interesting and complex ones. And one of the, you know, my background is as a journalist and as a specifically a business journalist. And I was really fascinated by the money aspects of all of this, the business side of this business. Another young woman, her name was Yamada Waka, and she had been forced into prostitution, ended up in Seattle, and then came down to San Francisco, ultimately took refuge in the Mission Home at 920 Sacramento Street. And her story is so remarkable. Again, she soaked up the education that she could get at the home, so much so that she ended up getting additional education through a Japanese tutor who was down the street. She and that tutor fell in love with each other. And right before the earthquake, they left and returned to Japan. Well, Yamada Waka ended up being a very influential feminist writer in Japan. She set up a rescue home that was very similar to the one she'd known at 920 Sacramento Street. And she finally went on book tour to the United States and was invited to the White House with the First Lady. And there's just a remarkable photograph of her in front of the White House that comes from the Library of Congress. And talk about the ways in which a life can change through education, through tenacity, and through people exercising or experiencing compassion and looking beyond racism and beyond the mores of the time.
How did you know that this was a story you needed to write?
That's a good question. I wanted to, on a very practical level, I wanted to write a story set in San Francisco. Originally, I was thinking of writing a story about San Francisco, but I realized that it was a better idea to tell the story of the city, tell the bubonic plague, tell the story of the earthquake, tell the story of the war years, the flu pandemic of 1918, tell it through a single house and ideally a few characters living in that house over a period of 70 years. So it was a remarkable thing to find a house where there were such good records through that whole period of time. And I got to say it for church people, they keep good records.
And it seemed like you were going through their records, through their diaries, letters in and out of Mission Home, as well as a lot of newspaper accounts. What other sources did you use besides those?
Well, this history is not that far away from us. For example, I went down to Evergreen Cemetery in Los Angeles to see the gravestones where Dolly Cameron and one of the women she worked closely with, Tian Fu Wu, are buried. And Tian only died in the late 1970s. Dolly Cameron only died in the late 60s. I was able to track down family members of Dolly Cameron who very generously shared a trunkload of material with me that had letters and had photographs. So I could talk to people who knew them. Likewise, Auntie Wu, she never had children, but people remembered her and could share their stories about her. So that was a very valuable thing. I also ended up going to the Highland Archive Center to try to track down where Dolly Cameron's family originally came from in Scotland. That was document kind of work. But I a little shout out as well to the unbelievably wonderful work of historians before me, and mostly Judy Young, who is a treasure, a California treasure. She's a former Chinatown librarian, now emeritus professor at UC Santa Cruz, and wrote enormously influential book about Chinese American women's history. So I'm very grateful to Judy.
Such a big story to write, and so many wonderful sources that you were able to find, because you're a journalist, so you knew how to find those sources. You knew how to work with them to get information that would be useful and that we would want to read about. The book is 339 pages, but then there's a lot more, because after the history that you give us, the index and the notes and so much more, with such a good story to write about, how did you know when to stop?
That's a really good question. Partly it was that I've decided I was going to follow the friendship between Dolly Cameron and the woman who I mentioned before, Tian Fu Wu, who had been sold into slavery by her father, took refuge at the home, and ended up working side by side with Dolly for decades. And so their friendship was a beautiful spine to kind of follow. And Dolly ended up leaving the home and retiring in the mid-30s. Tian stayed a little bit longer, but that's where I wanted to end. And I should be clear that my best estimate, based on working with the case files and with academics and with people who organize those case files, between 2,000 and 3,000 girls and women came through the home.
How many? Say that number again.
2,000 to 3,000 girls and women passed through the home.
Wow.
An occasional boy. And so there are a lot of people to have chosen from.
Yeah. What are some of the lessons that you get from this? Because history can be interesting, but it should also be and can also be a great teacher for us. So in terms of, let's say, in terms of treatment of women and children, what are the lessons that we carry forward from then to now that we can work with?
Sure. For me, perhaps the most striking lesson from the story is that a very small group of people can make a big change. If you look at the lives, the collected lives of those 2,000 to 3,000 women who took refuge there and then started families, that's potentially tens of thousands of people whose lives changed because of that small idea that someone had early on. I'd also like to say that I think those pioneers will give us insight into a fight that we're still fighting now, which is a fight against human trafficking. And they employed some methods that today's activists are employing as well. They testified in front of legislators. They fought to have the first anti-trafficking law in the state of California passed. They often use stories to pull at the heartstrings of potential donors. And certainly we see that now as well. So in my heart, I would love to see our California example being held up as an example of early anti-trafficking pioneers. So that's a lesson for me.
We have not had a chance, because we're talking so much about the White Devil's Daughters, as we should. We have not even mentioned some of the other books that you have written. Mm-hmm. Tell us just a little bit before we close about Lost Kingdom.
Sure. So Lost Kingdom is a book I wrote about the overthrow of the last queen of Hawaii. Her name was Liliuokalani. And it is a narrative history, so it starts in 1893 in January, and it follows her life in the subsequent year. Actually, it starts right before the overthrow, then dovetails back, tells her life as a royal, and what it was like, and then follows it from there. And it explores the sugar industry and of course, the great California character, Klaus Spreckels, who was known as the mm-hmm. Sugar King. So he's a mm-hmm. big character in the book. And mm-hmm. my book before that was called The House of Mondavi, which was about
which affects us even a little bit more. It's closer to home for us. How did you decide to write that?
Well, I wrote a newspaper feature about a clash in this family business. A publisher, after reading this story, reached out to me and said, would you consider writing a book about it? So I said, okay, I will.
Do you see a theme running between these?
I think there are a few themes. For one thing, it seems a little bit of a stretch, but the House of Mondavi is a fascinating story about power within families. And there's a scene that is, to me, unforgettable of the matriarch of the family, who's ostensibly the chairman of the board of the family business in the 50s after her husband dies, in fact, cooking lunch for her board of directors. She's in the mm-hmm. kitchen while they're making all the decisions, whereas her granddaughter ends up as really the victor in a billion-dollar takeover. The granddaughter casts the deciding vote in a boardroom battle and ends up with an enormous fortune. So women in power. Likewise, Lili Ulkalani stepped into a situation that was impossible and very much about losing power in that case. And how do you regain power, moral power, and cultural power in the face of a loss of the Kingdom of Hawaii? And of course, this book is all about women in power.
A lot of material there and a lot of interesting stories there, which begs the question, can you talk about what you'll be doing next or what you're already working on that we'll read next?
Oh, well, I am working on a new book, and I am a California girl. I am absolutely fascinated by California history, and it will be a book about a unsolved murder mystery in California, and it will take me to Sacramento, where I will be visiting the wonderful State Library.
A lot of research behind this, and we have touched on it a few places along the way, but we have to mention, you're a journalist, you are writing history. There isn't the creativity in this that a novelist brings to the table. So you have all of that research to do, and all of those facts to lay out for us. That's what we're reading in The White Devil's Daughters, and what we read in all of your books.
Well, I would say that the creativity comes in story choice, and in structuring the story. How do you tell the story so people are going to want to keep turning pages and are going to be touched by it, moved by it? That's my goal as a nonfiction writer, to kind of use some of the techniques of novelists, but in a nonfiction format.
Julia Flynn Seiler. Her book is The White Devil's Daughters. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Our recording and technical team was Frank Maranzino, Chris Hagen, and Tashina Brito. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books online, capradio.org/reads. Keep up with our latest conversations by subscribing to Cap Radio Reads on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. While you're at it, check out our other podcasts. Find them at capradio.org/podcast. I'm Donna Appadoni. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Capital Public Radio.